Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois.
A sunny afternoon for...
We have a live show coming to you today from Campbell Hall, and we're going to be talking with the executive director of FairVote, perhaps the leading group working to transform American elections to achieve equal access to participation in a full spectrum of meaningful choices and majority rule. Our guest will be Rob Ritchie today in Media Matters, but first, before we go to Rob Ritchie, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. This was a watershed week for media reform, with three important bills being passed by key congressional committees and a raucous rally and hearing at the Federal Communications Commission. Tuesday, the Senate Commerce Committee advanced the bipartisan Local Community Radio Act, which could help bring hundreds of local low-power FM radio stations to cities and suburbs across the country. A companion bill awaits action in the House. The Senate Commerce Committee also approved the bipartisan Community Broadband Act. This bill would overturn state prohibitions against cities and towns providing their own high-speed internet services. It promises to bring faster, cheaper, and more reliable broadband services to local communities that now find themselves on the wrong side of the digital divide. And in the House, the Energy and Commerce Committee passed the Broadband Census of America Act. Currently, there are no reliable numbers to measure high-speed internet access and availability in the United States, which has been falling behind the rest of the world. The bill would require both the National Telecommunications and Information Administration and the FCC to collect more and more accurate information. And to punctuate the week, on Halloween, hundreds of citizens rallied at FCC headquarters to send a message to big media and FCC Chairman Kevin Martin. The agency held its final localism hearing with only a few days' advance notice. Yet civil rights and labor leaders, consumer and media reform advocates, and a team of cheerleaders showed up to speak out against more media consolidation. Media Minutes will have more highlights from the event next week.
Media consolidation has had a detrimental effect on children's television programming, according to new research by Children Now, a California-based advocacy group focused on making children a top priority in public policy. Quality educational programming is beneficial to children, says Christy Globke, director of the group's Children in the Media program and author of the study Big Media, Little Kids 2. Globke says programs like Sesame Street can help young kids prepare for kindergarten, and the effects can last through high school.
For those students who may be more at a disadvantage, may not have access to quality preschool or access to a lot of books in their homes, it actually helps level the playing field for them.
The Big Media Little Kids 2 study looked at the effect of duopolies, those markets where one company owns two stations. They chose eight various sized markets, such as Chicago and El Paso, and compared programming in 2 years, 1998, before the duopolies were permitted, and 2006.
If you look at the hours of children's programming that was offered on the stations, duopolies decreased their programs over that time period, but the hours of programming by four times more than non-duopoly stations. And if you look at the number of series that were offered to kids, they decreased their programming by five times more than non-duopoly stations. So they were big decreases.
Broadcasters are reluctant to air children's programming because it isn't as lucrative as adult or sports programming. In 1996, Congress and the FCC required them to air at least 3 hours of children's educational programming per week. But broadcasters say that if kids are watching programming on cable, why should they have to air programming on broadcast channels? Globke has a couple of answers for them.
About 15% of kids don't have access to cable or satellite television. All they have is access to commercial broadcast television. The other part of it is that broadcasters are using a valuable public resource, the public airwaves, for free. They aren't paying for it. And because they use it for free, they need to give something back to the communities that they serve. And one of the very few ways that's been identified that require them to serve the public is children's educational programming.
Globke hopes the study will help policymakers understand the need for quality children's programming on broadcast stations. She says children's media advocacy isn't just about keeping bad media away from kids. It's really about helping to create good media that can benefit children. For more information about the study, go to childrennow.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to take up a topic we've covered periodically in Media Matters. We normally deal explicitly with media issues or work with journalists who deal with media or just journalists themselves and the work they're working on. Today we're going to turn to the subject of electoral reform, of voting reform, which is a very closely related issue to media and media reform and the institutional basis of self-government. So it's a common theme for us here, and it's a theme that's been very popular with listeners, and we've had lots of requests to continue in this vein. So today is our guest on Media Matters. We're very fortunate to have the executive director of Fair Vote, a nonprofit organization which has been perhaps the leader or one of the leaders in the movement to transform American elections. His name is Rob Ritchie. Rob Ritchie is the co-author of Every Vote Equal and also the co-author of Whose Votes Counts. His writings have appeared in newspapers across the country. He's been on all the major news media to discuss these issues. He is truly one of the great experts of our times. Rob Ritchie, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thank you, Bob. That's lavish praise, but right back at you, and I'm very pleased to be on the show.
Well, let's start in. There's so much to cover, because when I go through the body of your work, you really cover the waterfront of all the main electoral and voting rights issues, and there's a lot of turf here I want to cover today. The first one, though, I'd really like to get at is we have presidential elections coming up, and probably before some people blink, we'll have two nominees for the Republican and Democratic Party as soon as the end of January, fully 9 or 10 months before Election Day. We'll already know the two nominees of the Republican and Democratic Party. Can you just explain to the layperson who's sort of not a political junkie, who's just sort of not really following the presidential election very closely yet, what on earth is going on?
Well, it's a classic example of how our system isn't necessarily developing in a rational way. You know, here we pride ourselves on being a leader in democracy, and there are some elements of our democracy that work well. But as you know, in media, there's a lot to do, and certainly in voting, there is. And we have this very fractured state by state way of dealing with a lot of issues. Like, there are more than 13,000 jurisdictions that make decisions about the voting process that affect presidential races, and they can make, you know, different ones about ballot design and so on. In this case, you have different states all wanting to jockey among themselves to be close to the front of the cycle for who gets to vote first in the presidential primary season. In Iowa and New Hampshire have kind of proclaimed that it could be in the Constitution that they have to go first. Of course, it's not. But
yeah, I mean, that just developed in the last 30 or 40 years, didn't it?
Exactly. It's just they just kind of asserted their right to be there. New Hampshire did it first, and they had some exciting primaries like 1968 when McCarthy took on Johnson, and they sort of got a certain kind of allure, and then Iowa in 1976 with Carter. But there's no reason why they should get to go first every year, and other states resent that, and we saw in 2004 the kind of rush to embrace John Kerry after he won in Iowa in an upset and then carried that momentum into New Hampshire and then just kind of swept through, and then almost, you know, most of the remaining states had pretty meaningless primaries. And so what the parties have set up is that Iowa and New Hampshire are supposed to be able to go first under their party rules, but they set up the first Tuesday in February as kind of a free chance for everyone else. And a whole bunch of states moved up to their primary to February 5th. And then some states didn't stop there. They decided to kind of challenge the party rules, and Florida and Michigan and a couple other states have moved their votes into January. Iowa and New Hampshire feel they always should go first, so they've moved their votes up. And Iowa now says they're going to be on January 4th. In New Hampshire, the Secretary of State has the power under their statute to actually declare a primary in early December, or to tell us when the primary is going to be. And it may well be in December. So we actually may vote this year for next year's presidential nominee.
I mean, this is almost being reduced to the absurd. Why not have the primary this year for 2012?
I mean, well, some people are thinking about it. In fact, one of my colleagues was saying you really could test New Hampshire by some state setting a caucus for, you know, November 15th of 08 for 2012, and see if New Hampshire tries to schedule on election day or something. But and it's something we really can change. The parties have the power to change it, and there's some really good momentum within the parties to move to a more rational system. Congress is exploring potential changes, but it gets into some tricky ground where can Congress actually regulate party activity? And then, of course, states, when there are primaries and public, you know, publicly financed in the sense of running the elections, they have to kind of go along with the party rule, too, though a state like Iowa has a caucus, which is actually not paid for by the state. So there's sort of these different elements to how the law work out. But it is something we really can make better, and there's a range of really interesting proposals.
Some of the best ones, Rob Ritchie?
Well, I'd urge people to check them out at fixtheprimaries.com. It's a project we have, and it lays them out pretty well, fixtheprimaries.com. There's different ones. The one that we like best is called the American Plan, and it keeps the idea of a series of primaries and caucuses happening in a progress, you know, sort of a gradually larger number of states order. So there would be states with a total number of congressional districts of 8 voting first, but it would be done by lottery. So it wouldn't always be Iowa and New Hampshire. It could be one state with 8 congressional districts or 8 states with 1 each. And that would change every time. And then there would be a 2-week break, and then there would be states with a total of 16 congressional districts, and then 2-week break, and then those with 24. It would allow candidates to emerge from the pack to be able to focus their attention on the media in some ways early on, really trying to get those editorial endorsements in this, you know, the states that are first. But it would change every cycle, and there would be this kind of progressive flow in the size. And so let's say you stumble early on, you scream in an inopportune way on the night of the election or something like Howard Dean did, you still can recover because the biggest states and the most delegates wouldn't be allocated until the end. We could even see a situation like this next year. Let's say the candidates are all kind of stumbling and people really wanted an Al Gore or a Newt Gingrich or whomever to jump in. They still could, you know, because there'd be enough votes coming up later and enough delegates that, you know, people could turn to someone else, which I think is interesting. That's one proposal. There's a variation of that the Republicans almost passed in 2000. It's kind of one of the side stories of 2000. We would be having a whole different conversation right now if on the floor of the Republican convention in 2000 they had finished the process that they nearly did, which was to establish what they call the Delaware Plan, which would have Delaware and other small states always voting first. So it would be the 13 smallest states always voting first. Mm-hmm. Then a one-month break, so a big break. And then the next biggest 13 states, then another one-month break, and so on until the final states vote, which has some interesting merits as well. I'd be pretty sympathetic to that. There's a new proposal put forward by Jonathan Soros in the New York Times that I thought was quite interesting just last week. His idea is to say, well, the only way to really have every vote equal is to have a national primary. But if you just sort of had a national primary where everyone voted the same day, it would just be, you know, a huge money issue and no chance for real deliberation. But his thought was you could start the voting in early January and finish it in late June and have early voting and vote by mail, and then release ballot results periodically, maybe every week or every 2 weeks or something. So you could say, well, here's where the horse race is, but there'd be a space between those. And it'd be a really interesting sort of gaming of what it might look like, because a lot of people don't want to just vote for necessarily the person they like the most. They want to vote for the one they think is going to be the winner. And you won't really know it at the point. So the people who are likely to vote early are the ones who really are committed to their candidates. And you can't necessarily buy that commitment with, you know, spending lots of money and so on. It's got to be earned in a sense. And you could have, you know, a candidate could say, well, I'm going to really focus in one state, and I'll report how I do. You know, we'll all see how I do after 2-3 weeks, and you can really see how that candidate does when people really get to know them. It's kind of an interesting idea. It's an area where we find people have come up with a lot of different ideas, and I think any number of them are better than what we have now.
Our guest